Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I, Paula, are delighted to be with Robert A.G. Monks. I was out of the country not very long ago with a group of women from all over the world who, once they got comfortable with the fact that I wasn't going to defend America's current policies, were willing to be quite candid, and they said, "What has happened to America? Something has changed from the America we thought we knew." And in fact, some things have changed. You start in 1971 with Supreme Court Justice Powell was, by a couple months, was a Supreme Court Justice. You talk about specific things that have happened, including the Business Roundtable. So the question of what happened to America has some predicates. You want to start with the Business Roundtable?
Well, yes, the Business Roundtable was something that was very much needed in America, as business interests had been incredibly poorly represented for many years, and there was a very bad imbalance as the legitimate interest of our society to have a healthy business was being impeded by the incompetence of the business group. And John Connally, the former governor of Texas, at least by rumor, is reported to have gone up to Washington and explained to the people how to do it. And they put together about 73, 74, this business roundtable. It was to be just chief executives and very, very tightly run by an executive committee, only a couple of hundred of them. They couldn't send delegates to meetings. They had to go themselves. They didn't have much of a staff at the business roundtable, so they used the corporate staffs, which of course were excellent people. And the executive committee gave them projects to do. Well, what became clear to me one day is I started a company called ISS, Institutional Shareholder Services, about 20 years ago. And a couple of iterations later, when my son was the chairman of it and I was no longer involved, the CEO of the company was a man named John Connally, and he was sitting in his office, and he was visited by the John Castellani, who is the executive running the business roundtable, who proceeded to berate him about a recommendation that ISS made about the pay of Henry McKinnell of Pfizer.
Back to Pfizer.
Well, it turned out that Henry McKinnell wasn't only the CEO of Pfizer, he was the head of the Business Roundtable. And so the idea that the Business Roundtable was using its executives' time and energy to promote the personal interest of individual CEOs made me think again and say, look, how can you explain this statistical discrepancy where there's no correlation between CEO pay and any kind of addition of value to anybody? It didn't just happen. When I remembered my childhood, and I remembered Sherlock Holmes, you know, and when every other possibility doesn't explain it, well, you'd have to say that at some point, quite clearly, there was a level of agreement among these people. And that with that level of agreement, and there are several very good articles in the New York Times talking about top people in the business roundtable meeting and putting pressure on accountants about their attitude about stock options. And these are consistent with a theory that the business roundtable was the sort of vehicle through which meeting CEOs were able to fix the price of chief executive compensation.
You talk about fixing, you talk about gaming the system, you talk about the stock market becoming a grand casino, you talk about cheating. Mm. These are not typically core American values. So that's part of what's happening here, isn't it?
I think that there was such success in an escalation of CEO pay, where people always thought CEOs would be rich, but they didn't necessarily think that they all had to be in the same position as someone who'd founded the company and who'd been at an equity risk all that time. This changed over that period of time.
And they are managers.
And they're managers. And so the nature of the job was redefined, and they became partners.
There's the illusion of objectivity because these people hire compensation consultants who come in and do analysis and objectively evaluate what the going rate in the market is and say that you're worth $250 million because that's what the going rate is. I don't remember the exact word that you used to describe that, but it's something in the range of poppycock.
Or hogwash, or one of those.
Well, you know, there's a wonderful example. I don't have it in the book, but compensation of the chief executive of Fannie Mae has been very sharply questioned. And there is a regulatory agency called OFHEO, which is set up by Congress simply to audit Fannie Mae. And they did an investigation that revealed a discussion in which an executive of Fannie Mae is suggesting people who could be advisors to the audit to the compensation committee. And the person to whom they make the suggestion comes back to them and says, I've just gone to the boss, and he doesn't want to have Snodgrass on that because he doesn't think his attitude is right. Well, there it is. It's there for you, that the whole process is one that is dominated by the CEO. And he picks the consultants, he picks the people on the committee, and so the independence is simply a ghastly distortion of a word that otherwise is a very reputable one.
You used early on the word power. Money, second only to brute force, money in the world we live in, capital more generally, is a tremendous source of power. It provides personal power, it provides power to a corporation. A corporation that has accreted large sums of money, mm-hmm. Or even has, you know, controls the flow of it, mm-hmm. Has tremendous power. And that power can be exercised for good. It can be exercised solely for the benefit of the corporation, or it can be used to do some not very good things. And part of the story you're telling seems to be that some of that is the latter case. Not the least of which is chief executives who, because they have the power and the control, are enriching themselves at the expense of their stockholders.
Well, that's the smoking gun. And, you know, if I always say to myself, as I've spent a great deal of energy over the last 20 years trying to improve corporate governance, and I must say I haven't been very successful. And the evidence of not being successful is that if you can't stop someone from paying themselves whatever they want to, you really can't deduce that you really have any impact at all, because
but they are essentially, as you describe it, and it seems to be accurate. They are essentially no checks on their power.
No effective checks.
No effective checks.
Yeah, there's lots of nominal. I mean, there are committee structures that have kept legions of lawyers employed for years. But as a practical matter, the power is in the CEO. He uses the power, he dominates the committee structure, he dominates the hiring of consultants. And I've occasionally persuaded people to speak up, and I have to tell you, it's like trying to get people to volunteer for kamikaze missions.
You talk about process, and you say, you know, that sounds like a boring word. You also talk about governance, and quite to the contrary, this isn't boring. Mm. This is the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. This is at the heart of who we are, how we are, what we're going to allow among and between people. This is the political economy. So governance, of which you have, to which you've given so much attention, of which you've been a part. And again, it's, I think, important to say that you're not talking as an outsider, you're talking as an insider from all kinds of insider perspectives. The way we govern and are governed is central to how we do or do not have a functioning society.
Absolutely. And I think the word corpocracy means the corporation and its interests taking over the political system. And you begin to think of, I don't know when the history of this time is written, what will be said about the privatization of the military functions in the Iraq war. But clearly the agenda is very much influenced by the possibility of profit for private companies. And exactly how profound is that, and what's the chicken and what's the egg? At some point we're going to find out. We don't know, but we certainly have a lot of evidence that the role of the corporations as providers of legal violence, legal in quotes, has been critical to the United States' capacity to stay there. The president has said so himself. And what I think of myself, you were talking, Paul, about how we're a different country. I think of myself, and I have three draft-age grandchildren. And if we had a draft, and if our involvement in Iraq required a political consensus adequate to support a draft, would I be doing the same things I'm doing today about Iraq? I would not. I would be lying down on Pennsylvania Avenue, kicking and screaming. And I'm not doing any of that. Well, my diminished citizenship, of which I'm ashamed, probably is representative of other people. And in effect, this is one more thing that we've corporatized. We've corporatized the use of violence. It used to be you could only use violence when you got political consent to do it.
I grew up at a time when the Hessians were reviled. The Hessians fought for the British in the Revolutionary War.
And as mercenaries.
They were reviled because they were mercenaries. They weren't fighting for principle. They weren't fighting for their country. They weren't fighting for the good against evil. They were fighting for money. And that's just gone away.
I tell you what comes around goes around. We're the mercenaries. We're the Hessians today.
Right. And you talk about arrogance in that context. And arrogance as part of this equation is very important.
Yes, it is.
Pride cometh before the fall.
Yes. I have to say that whenever I say that, and then I say, well, God, I hope it doesn't take the whole country with it. At the same time, I hope you're right. I hope that this arrogance doesn't go unrequited.
We'll be back in just a moment for a few more minutes with Robert A.G. Monks. Be with us when we return.